We come in the fifth chapter of the book of Genesis to the family tree of the human race from Adam down until Noah. And the chapter opens with another statement of God's creation. God created man in the likeness of God, made he him. Here's the nature of man, created in God's image. Now, in this chapter, and I'll not read the whole chapter because it's the kind of material you'd find in a cemetery on the tombstones. It's how long this person lived and who his parents and children were. We might notice in this chapter, though, that Adam lived 930 years, and that Methuselah, Noah's grandfather, lived 969 years. And then over in the next chapter, it's going to tell us that God cut the lifespan of human beings to 120 years. And then sometime after the flood, it's going to be cut to 70 or 80 years. You know, in Psalm 90, it says the days of our years are 70 years and 10. And if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet you have problems through this period. Here's the gradual shortening of the lifespan of human beings. Now, one or two of the important people in this passage, here's Enoch, Noah's great-grandfather. And verse 24 of chapter 5 says, he walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. And the book of Hebrews is going to tell us that by faith this man walked with God. And we'll not tarry with it, but to walk with God means to live a godly life. And in general, if we're going to walk with somebody, we've got to be going the same direction in which they are going. In this world, as it became more and more godless, as sin expressed itself in all areas of living, here was a man who walked with God. And we're going to have Methuselah, the man who lived the longest, 969 years. Again, Noah's grandfather. Then, we're going to have in chapter 6, the further development of evil. The intermarriage of the godly line with the ungodly. Probably the intermarriage of the line of Cain with the line of Seth. And it talks about the beginning of polygamy right there in the first verses of chapter 6, verse 2. Now, I know that there are a good many study Bibles that want to say that this is the intermarriage of evil spirits with human women. The problem with that is that we're told so clearly in the New Testament that these angels neither marry nor are given in marriage. Mark 12:25. And you say, but these were evil spirits. Yes, but they were still had an angelic nature. And it's not the kind of thing that you want to argue about, but I think this is the intermarriage of the ungodly with those people who were closer to God. And again, if you want to believe now that this is the intermarriage of humans and evil angels, you'll certainly have a lot of good company on your side. But this is the direction that the human race is taken. And so in verse 3 of chapter 6, God says, my spirit shall not always strive with man. God's not going to keep on putting up with this. And verse 5 says, God saw that the wickedness of man was very great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Here's where evil comes from the thoughts, the purposes, the desires of the heart, the bent of the will toward evil. You know, the New Testament's going to say, out of the heart proceed murders, adulteries, and all kinds of things like that. Or, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And so God saw that man had a perverted, sinful nature. And in verse 7, the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth. God, because he is holy and righteous, must judge sin. And you're familiar with the idea that so many people just don't want to hear about this. The idea that God judges. The idea that God has actually prepared hell for the devil and his angels and the people who are determined, as it were, to go with them. But here's the idea that God's going to judge. And so, at this point, verse 8 tells us Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. The New Testament tells us that Noah had faith, and that it was by faith he was moved with fear and prepared an ark for the saving of his house. Then this tells us that God grieved because of the conditions that were here upon the earth. God doesn't want to punish, and yet his holiness demands that sin be punished. And so God's going to tell Noah about the coming flood and how he is to build an ark. And of course, Jesus is going to pick this up and say this is going to be a picture of the last days. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. And he's going to say these folks were eating and drinking. Nothing wrong with that. Marrying and giving in marriage. Nothing wrong with that. But that's all they were doing, until the day that the flood came. All right, here then is the picture of God preparing Noah for the flood, telling him to build the ark, 300 cubits long, a cubit's a foot and a half, 18 inches, so 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Now, I deliberately want to tarry 5 minutes and to suggest to you, I hope clearly, that this is real history and that Noah's Ark is still over on Mount Ararat, where it landed after the flood. I take it that it's fairly common knowledge that the flood story was known all over the earth long before man got the Bible. The American Indians, South America, North America, too, knew the flood story long before Columbus came and folks like that. The Indians on the Orinoco River in Venezuela knew the flood story before anybody came from Europe. Many tribes of them, the ancient Greeks, the ancient Brazilians, the folks in Peru, the natives of Cuba way back yonder, the natives of Tahiti, many American Indian tribes, some of the Indian tribes over here in Virginia years and years ago, knew the flood story. In Northern Europe, I don't mean Northern Europe now, I'm talking about way back yonder in Scandinavia, the folks in ancient China, the Hindus in India. There's a written copy of the Babylonian flood story, the Gilgamesh epic. Berossus, the famous Babylonian historian, tells the flood story. Josephus, the best known, I expect, Jewish historian, has a mention of the ark three different times. In fact, he tells us three different times about the remains of the ark being there in his lifetime. Now, here's the summary. In one of the books about this, The Ark on Ararat by Tim LaHaye and John Morris, it lists by name 215 ancient peoples all over the world who had the flood story long, long before they had a Bible. It's not just that this is in ancient history. There are some 200 people that are known to have seen the Ark since 1856, in the last 130 years or so. Some of you will know about George Hagopian. Sometimes Temizian is the way it's pronounced. But this man lived in America, and he grew up right at the foot of Mount Ararat, and his uncle took him up to see the remains of the Ark in 1902, and then again a little bit later. And this is the man who tells you about the window of the Ark. You know, the Bible talks about the window of the Ark. If you get old sketches of the Ark, it looks like one little window. No. What really was built into the Ark was a long window with some 50 sections. And this man, who grew up at the foot of the hill and used to go up there with his uncle, tells you that there's something like 50 divisions in this window. You couldn't get enough air for all those animals from one little bitty window. And if you get new drawings of the Ark, they'll have the window going almost all the way down the roof. Not that that's a big thing, but I think it's very definite. The Russians have done a great deal of exploration of Mount Ararat. You see, Mount Ararat's right on the Russian border, and back in 1916-17, they had expeditions up there. There was an American oil pipeline and mining engineer, George Jefferson Green, that took pictures of the Ark from an airplane in 1952. Now, later he was killed in an accident. The French explorer Ferdinand Navarra climbed Ararat in 52 and 55. And American scholars like John Warwick Montgomery, a law school professor, has climbed the Ark. Now, when I say that Montgomery is a law school professor, some of you will think of the Christian books he's written. Oh, yes. But the thing he's interested in now is teaching in law school, and I think that's what he's doing. There have been a good many British explorers. The Archbishop John Joseph Nowry, the Prince of Nowry, of the Nestorian Church, visited the Ark back in 1887, and later he came to this country. Now, let me say it this way. You could go on for hours with that kind of information. There's no end of it. You say, well, why don't they just go up there sometime and get some real good, clear pictures of it, and so everybody can see them? Well, this is right on the Russian frontier, and the Turks don't want foreigners up there on the Russian frontier. Now, the prohibition of foreigners climbing Mount Ararat was lifted in 82, and this past summer, there were three different expeditions up on Mount Ararat. And the one that we thought was going to bring back some real information had trouble with their airplane. It just broke down, the helicopter that was going to take them up, and they didn't get all the material that they'd hoped to get. But I think if you're going to believe that Columbus discovered America in 1492 and things like that, I think you're going to have to believe that the Ark is still over there on Mount Ararat, and folks have brought back samples of the wood and tested them, and it tests out to be something several thousand years old, maybe anyway, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. And you don't get exact dates from carbon 14, but you get approximate dates. Now, in this story, the flood was God's judgment on rebellion and violence and humanism. The flood shows God's control over the world and his government of it. Now, in this chapter, it talks about how God prepared Noah and how when the time came, God told Noah to take into the ark two of some animals and seven of some animals. The seven, they were the clean animals, the one acceptable for sacrifice. Noah's going to offer a sacrifice when he gets out of the ark. Well, you don't want to take some of the pairs of animals, and so extra ones of these were provided. And so when Noah is something like 600 years old, he goes into the ark, and his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and they take with them their wives. And so when Noah gets into this big ark that he's built by faith now, he trusted in God enough to build this thing. Nobody had ever seen a flood. Nobody ever told a flood story before this. But he believed God, and so he obeyed and built the ark. And then when he got in, the canopy of water that had been up over the earth simply breaks loose, and it rains 40 days and 40 nights. Then it talks about the fountains of the great deep being broken up, and things like this. And the flood, of course, was all over the world. I think that's why you go up on high mountains in many parts of the world, and you'll find just big deposits of the shells of deep sea creatures and things like that. Now, of course, there'd been the upthrust. Those of us who live in this part of the country can see how there have been upthrusts in the earth's crust. On most any new highway that's cut through the mountain, you can see the folds of the earth's crust. But anyway, the fountains of the deep were broken up. And there was a rearrangement of the oceans that now had so much more water. And so Noah stays in the ark a year, maybe a year and 10 days. I was looking at the figures here, but right at a year, maybe a year and a little bit longer. And then by that time the waters had receded, and God told him that at this point he was to leave the ark. There's a great deal about material about Noah. In the New Testament, we're told that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Here was a man who preached, and evidently nobody paid any attention to him. Nobody joined him in the ark. Oh, no. I expect in our language they thought he was crazy. But the New Testament tells us that he was a preacher of righteousness. And then, of course, when he comes out of the ark on God's instruction, the first thing he does is to build an altar. And he took of these clean beasts and offered burnt offerings. And God, it says, smelled the sweet savor. And God said, there won't be any more floods. I'll never again smite every living thing. And while the earth remains, there'll always be seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. Until Christ comes back, and probably after that, the days and nights, the seasons are going to continue as they've been. Some winters be a little bit warmer than the others. Incidentally, that's why you can't climb Mount Ararat just any year. It's got to be a year that's had enough hot summer weather to melt the ice down. Not all the winters are just alike, but there's going to be winter and summer, harvest and seed time and things like this. And so Noah and his sons come out of the ark, and then God says to them, be fruitful and multiply. And in chapter 9, God gives Noah some instructions. God says, every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. Man is to eat hamburgers and bacon and other kinds of meat, turkey, chicken, and the green herbs. That means the plants in the garden. But the flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood, ye shall not eat. In other words, man is not to eat blood. And then, in verse 6 of chapter 9, there's something for our generation. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. Now, here's God's instruction after the judgment of the wicked pre-flood world. He says, Noah, from this point on, there must be capital punishment when somebody has deliberately committed murder. Now, you see, so many modern men in Europe and America don't want any capital punishment for anybody. And, of course, the thing back of that, and once you understand why a modern man wants this, then you'll know how to receive it. This is, don't blame it all on B.F. Skinner and men like that, but Skinner's book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, says so clearly that man's not responsible for what he does. It's his environment that makes him do it. So there aren't any criminals. And so, of course, you ought not to have capital punishment. Oh, no. And again, I'm just talking about the mainstream of American thinking. Now, God's told us clearly that some sins are so serious that they must be judged. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. And if you turn the criminals loose, I mean this kind of criminal, the probability is that you'll have the same crime or other crimes repeated. All right, God gives them other instructions. I'm looking at verse 11 of chapter 9. I will establish my covenant with you. Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of the flood. Neither shall there any more be a flood to destroy the earth. And there's not going to be any more floods. Now, in this 9th chapter, we have the story. You just wouldn't believe it if you weren't here, that after the flood, Noah got to be a husbandman. That means he started gardening. And says he planted a vineyard and drank of the wine and was drunken. Strong men fail at their points of strength. We have the idea that it's the weak man who fails at his point of weakness. Well, yes. Any policeman could write you a book about that. But it's a fairly common thing for the strong man to fail at his strong point. Elijah's strong point was bravery. He's not afraid of 850 false prophets on the other side. God's on his side. Yeah, but his man got scared and ran off all the way out of the country when Jezebel was after him. Moses, of all people in history, was the meek man. Now, the Bible calls him the meekest of men. Yes, but he's the one who lost his temper in the worship service and struck the rock. I never have seen a preacher lose his temper in the pulpit. Maybe some of you have. Well, that's the kind of thing Moses did. I'm talking about how strong people fail at their point of strength. Now, Noah's specialty was he was a godly man in an ungodly world. And Here's the man that just plain got drunk. And now, this should be a warning to us. This is, I think, why the New Testament says we're to consider ourselves, lest we also be tempted. And it's so easy for some of us to say, oh, we wouldn't get drunk. No, I went through the war in a rifle company. I know what liquor will do to you. I know about my fellow soldiers getting a bottle and then walking off into the presence of the enemy, and you don't ever see them again. I've seen what strong drink will do in this community. And I could spend an hour telling you the stories. I won't. But I'd better watch, unless somehow I'm tempted at that point to do what Noah did. And so here again is this good man who was drunken, and then you were going to have the story about how one of his sons, Ham, rejoiced in this iniquity. And Shem and Japheth, Noah was so drunk that he lost his clothes, and these other boys covered him up in respect. And so, here again is the good man falling down. Here's the good man stumbling. This is why we Christians need to pray for each other and for ourselves. And we're going to come in our next study to chapter 10. And here is going to be some more of the family tree. The family tree of Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and their descendants are on down until we come almost to the time of Abraham. This is just right after the flood. And the Lord willing, we'll come back to chapter 11 in our next study.